Hey everyone, it's Mark in Chicago, and this is Media Riot. In this episode, we look at, in movie theaters now, The Return of the Dinosaurs, again, in Jurassic World. In music, we take a listen to the latest from Florence and the Machine on their album, How Big, How Blue, How Beautiful. We also take a listen to Tom DeLonge of Blink-182 fame, his first solo album titled To the Stars, Demos, Odds and Ends. And in theater, we see if we fall slowly for once the musical like we did once the movie.
It's not about control.
Stand down. It's a relationship. Based on respect. These animals are thinking, I gotta eat. I gotta hunt. You gotta be able to relate to at least one of those things.
Every time we've unveiled a new attraction, attendance has spiked.
That was awesome.
Corporate felt genetic modification would up the wow factor.
They're dinosaurs, wow enough.
She was designed to be bigger than a T-Rex.
What happened to the sibling?
She ate it. We have an asset out of containment. What is that?
Her tracking implant, she clawed it out.
How would it know to do that?
She remembered where they put it in.
Oh, God.
She's killing for sport.
You got 20,000 people. You got no more boats. You don't have enough guns.
If we do this, we do this my way.
We got eyes on target.
Light it up!
Something's wrong. They're communicating.
We're talking about an animal here.
A highly intelligent animal.
In theaters now is Jurassic World, the fourth film in the Jurassic Park series. Set 22 years after the first Jurassic Park, and kind of sort of ignoring parts 2 and 3, Jurassic Park is now called Jurassic World and has been up and running without incident for about 10 years. In the movie, people have become tired of the regular old dinosaurs Jurassic World has to offer, which makes no sense. Actually, there's a lot of no sense moments throughout this whole movie. So in order to keep the people and the money flowing, the higher-ups want a faster, bigger, scarier dinosaur, because, yeah, what could go wrong with that? So what happens to their bigger, faster, scarier, and now smarter dinosaur? It breaks free, and makes Jurassic World its bitch. There's a lot of excitement and a lot of stupid in Jurassic World. Now I'm giving Jurassic World 3 stars. And that's mostly because of the technical stuff. The plot and the characters, not so much. The first Jurassic Park was a watershed moment in film history. Special effects had finally caught up to the human imagination, and dinosaurs could be realistically rendered on screen. Seamlessly switching between CG and practical effects, Jurassic Park wowed the world, and with Steven Spielberg at the helm, you knew you were getting top quality thrills and scares. Yes, Jurassic Park was more or less land Jaws, but not as perfect as Jaws, but it was still fresh and exciting with some interesting ideas about man versus nature thrown in. Jurassic Park had a brain in its head. The park was going to be small and manageable, you know, because you're dealing with man-eaters. But, as it was said in the movie, nature finds a way. The dinosaurs got loose due to human failure and attacked those that tried to control them. The following two sequels have people interact with dinosaurs, but not like it's a small world ride at at Disneyland. Because no matter how in control you think you are of these animals, they're still wild animals. Dogs and cats have been domesticated for hundreds of years, but still swipe and bite at you if pissed off. So this leads me to the first problem with Jurassic World. They treat the dinosaurs like, yeah, it's part of the It's a Small World ride. You can ride a baby Triceratops like it's a Shetland pony. You can see a SeaWorld-style show of a dinosaur that snacks on great white sharks like we would on goldfish crackers. And the stupidest ride imagined, but, you know, how else are they going to get the plot to move forward? They place two people in a human-sized hamster ball so you can roll about with the more, quote-unquote, docile dinosaurs that, you know, are five-ton animals that, if freaked out, could stomp on the bubble. Now, pretty much Jurassic World is a repeat of Jurassic Park. Now, even though the characters in the movie are aware of the Jurassic Park failures, they still think they can control the dinosaurs. Plus, let's throw in that even more powerful dinosaur. So for me personally, from the start, everyone in the film who's trying to make more money off of these dinosaurs is an idiot. My other serious complaint about the movie is that, like the Indominus Rex, the genetically grown hybrid dinosaur, the plot is a hybrid of other movies. Jurassic World leans heavily on Jurassic Park, like the Poltergeist remake. Jurassic World reenacts scenes from the first movie to lesser results. I know they want to call them Easter eggs, like, ooh, look, a hat from the first film. Or they think they're homaging or something, you know, but really it's lazy writing. And Spielberg was heavily involved in this film, including the writing. So, yeah, that's kind of weird. But Jurassic World reminded me a lot of a Jaws movie. Not the perfect Jaws 1, but Jaws 3, where the shark goes to SeaWorld. Chris Pratt is like Dennis Quaid in Jaws 3. Pratt has his raptors to help him fight the Indominus Rex, and Quaid has dolphins to help him fight the shark. An unrelated knock against Jurassic World is that last year we got the new great dinosaur movie, Godzilla, directed by Gareth Edwards, who openly admits to making his own version of Jaws with Godzilla, but in that case, Godzilla worked. Actually, I'll put it this way. Where Godzilla is a better film overall, it does lack in hot dinosaur action. And where Jurassic World lacks in creativity, it makes up for dinosaur fight scenes. Now, Jurassic World was directed by Colin Trevorrow. Don't worry if you've never heard his name. He only has one other feature film under his belt, and it was awful. Now, I'm kind of in the minority about Trevorrow's film, his previous film, Safety Not Guaranteed. The gist of the film is that some guy puts an ad in the newspaper looking for a partner to travel through time with. But your safety is not guaranteed. Get it? Safety Not Guaranteed sits at 91% on Rotten Tomatoes and won a bunch of indie film awards, and that's where it should stay, in the indie world, where nobody really needs to see it. The characters are dicks, they use that shitty, shaky camera work, and the time machine is such a moron, like in the Napoleon Dynamite vein, that the film feels like a giant fuck you to the audience. Oh, and spoiler alert, because you never need to see this movie, Napoleon Dumbass actually builds the time machine. Now, I guess because both films are science fiction to a point is why Trevorrow got the nod to direct Jurassic World, but to call Safety Not Guaranteed full-on science fiction is like comparing Jaws 2 to Kramer vs. Kramer because, you know, they both have family drama. Though, in the end, Jurassic World could have been directed by anyone since Spielberg was heavily involved in Jurassic World. Plus, 20-plus years has passed, and that's enough time to make a sequel feel fresh. As for the characters in Jurassic World, they're interesting enough, and no one's a dick. Chris Pratt plays Owen Grady, a former Navy guy, now raptor trainer. They never say if he was like a SEAL or did intelligence or something like that, because how does working in the Navy prepare you to be a raptor trainer? Pratt's character, Grady, more or less fills the role for Bob Peck's character, Muldoon, from Jurassic Park. Bryce Dallas Howard is the park's operating officer. She plays the girl, like Laura Dern did. Irfan Khan, as the CEO, has taken over for the deceased John Hammond. Vincent D'Onofrio, as the head of security, has a secret evil plan for the dinosaurs, kind of like Wayne Knight's character Dennis Nedry in Jurassic Park. There's one actual returning, not reworked, character from Jurassic Park, B.D. Wong as Dr. Wu, the head geneticist for Jurassic World. And how he can ethically continue to work for InGen's Jurassic whatever is never talked about. Now, everyone turns in a good performance. Movies like these are probably fun to make. You get to run and jump and shoot guns, and then you get paid. But, you know, those are just the actors. The real stars of Jurassic World are the dinosaurs. And, oh yeah, they look good. I'm sure at points there are practical dinosaurs, you know, like puppets, but there hasn't been any news about using both, so it might actually just be all CG effects. The one thing they did get wrong with the dinosaurs is that they humanize, sorry, the dinosaurs a little too much. There's a very famous comedic bit by Richard Pryor who gives voices to all the animals he encounters, especially his neighbor's dog, who he talks to about the passing of his pet monkeys. It's absolutely hilarious. Check it out. In watching the actors in Jurassic World interact with the dinosaurs, I wouldn't have been surprised at a certain point if the dinosaurs just turned to Chris Pratt and went, "What up, bro?" But there's a part in the film that made me laugh out loud like I was watching Airplane or The Naked Gun. When two dinosaurs defeat another dinosaur and they look at each other, I seriously thought they were going to high-five or fist bump, which would have been double hilarious since a lot of, you know, the upright 2 feet dinos have stubby arms. Picture two T-Rexes trying to fist bump, yeah. But like I said earlier, Jurassic World is filled with a lot of dino action scenes, and they're very well done. They have the look of Spielberg's action scenes from Jurassic Park 1 and 2, and because enough time has passed, the film feels fresh and the digital effects are great. So yeah, I'm begrudgingly giving Jurassic World 3 stars, but really, like my opinion matters this time around. Even though I had lower expectations for Jurassic World, I wanted to see the new Jurassic Park movie, because those dinosaurs look really cool. And also, you know, like I said with Godzilla, who doesn't like some hot dino on dino action? Oh, come on. Woo. Let's get it on. Baby. Let's get it on. Let's love, baby. Let's get it on. Out with their third album, Florence and Her Machine set up their wind machines and long billowy scarves and epically and gossiply rock out on their album How Big, How Blue, How Beautiful. Let's take a listen to a track. Killer whale. Once you get past the title that sounds like Smurf porn, you have one of the best albums of the year. Florence Welch and her band The Machine continue to bring us epic indie rock, glazed in gospel with poetic personal lyrics. Even though their debut album, Lungs, sold more than their second album, Ceremonials, it felt like after the release of Ceremonials, Flo and the boys were everywhere. Almost every radio station was playing the hit song, Shake It Out. Seriously, because I just said the name of the song, it's now in your head. You know it is. Following the band's finishing their almost two-year nonstop world tour, the label told Flo and the boys to take their time on making their next album. And during that time, Florence reported that she had a little bit of a breakdown, and that things weren't totally right with her leading into the beginning of the recording of this album. Because of that, Flo says that Big Blue Beautiful is her most personal album to date. I didn't really notice a huge difference in content, but Florence and the Machine are just so damn talented that she could sing the Transformers cartoon theme song and make it sound like a personal religious awakening. Flo and the boys brought on Marcus Dravs as producer on this album, a wise choice in helping the band wrangle their epic sound. Dravs is known for producing albums by The Arcade Fire, Coldplay, and Mumford & Son, winning Grammys for Album of the Year for The Arcade Fire, The Suburbs, and Mumford & Son's Babel. Will this be another Album of the Year? I don't really see that, but this should be on top 10 list at the end of the year. Mumford & Son's Wilder Mind wasn't produced by Dravs, and, well, we know how that turned out. So, how did the songs on Big Blue Beautiful turn out? In a press release, Flo said about this album, "I guess although I've always dealt in fantasy and metaphor when I came to writing, that meant the songs this time were dealing much more in reality. Ceremonials was so fixated on death and water and the idea of escape and transcendence through death, but the new album became about trying to learn how to live and how to love in the world rather than trying to escape from it, which is frightening because I'm not hiding behind anything, but it felt like something I had to do." And you know what? Yeah, sure. Her lyrics are very poetic, and poetry is subjective. Like, here are some lyrics from the song Queen of Peace. "Like the stars chase the sun, over the glowing hill I will conquer. Blood is running deep, some things never sleep." Okay. But she sings it so well over great music that, you know, she could be talking about ants blowing each other. I don't know. It sounds beautiful. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not knocking this album. I'm actually giving it a very strong 3 stars. Buy it, download it, stream it, listen to it. You will not be disappointed. And, you know, and if it seems I love it so much, why only 3 stars? Well, because this is Florence and the Machine, so we're already starting at 3 stars, just due to the talent in this band. But comparing it to their other previous albums, it's not really breaking too much new ground. I wouldn't say it's a weak album. It's just more of a, hey, here's more Florence and the Machine. I guess you can nail it down by saying there really isn't a breakout pop hit like Shake It Out or my personal favorite, Never Let Me Go. And yes, Flo gets labeled as an indie band, but because they don't make Taylor Swift songs, but Flo and the boys do make songs that are radio friendly, which isn't a bad thing because if Florence and the Machine and Arcade Fire are able to find their way onto the radio, hey, you know, that's awesome. So I'm glad we got a new album from Flo and the Machine, and it's still great. And maybe with the next album, Flo and the Boys will take it to the next level. I mean, the Rolling Stones had many number one singles over a decade and a half period, so Florence the Machine can, you know, next album can come out with another number one hit. And just remember, if you shake it out more than once, you're playing with it. Out with his first official solo album, former, or on hiatus from the band, whatever his lawyer says this week, Blink-182 guitarist Tom DeLonge wants you to go to the stars with him on his album To the Stars, Demos, Odds, and Ends. Let's take a listen to a track. Okay, I'm gonna say it. It doesn't totally suck. Now, let's quickly put this into perspective. Reviewing Tom DeLonge is like reviewing the band Korn, okay? Tom DeLonge got famous for writing pop, and I mean pop punk songs about growing up and girls and feeling sad and shit in the band Blink-182. These guys were never that deep. They have an album titled Enema of the State, and another one called Take Off Your Pants and Jacket. A lame pun meaning take off your pants and jack it. You know, your junk. Ha ha, 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 ho, ho, ha, he, ha, 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 ha. Their humor is pretty sophomoric, and it was never as clever as witty as they thought. But then they turn around and write a song like Stay Together for the Kids, which is about divorce, man. You see? They're deep. There's levels, man. There's the levels to them. Blink never should have achieved the level of success they did with their childish shit. After the 1-2 commercial punch of Enema and Take, Tom felt Blink was stifling him and he needed to grow, so he formed Boxcar Racer, which sounds like a little less poppier than Blink. Tom said it was formed from his influences of Fugazi and The Refused. And if you just laughed out loud at that comparison, yeah, you're right on. They recorded one crappy generic punk album and disbanded. The Blink guys begrudgingly returned to record their untitled album in 2003, and after some touring, the band went on, quote-unquote, indefinite hiatus. Code for, we broke up, but we might want to come back to milk this cash cow again. During the hiatus, the guys formed or played with other bands. Tom had the most success with his band Angels and Airwaves, which, if it didn't have Tom DeLonge of Blink-182, they wouldn't have gotten any notoriety. They pretty much suck on all levels. Since Tom was famous and had money, he was able to recruit talented musicians. So the only thing Angels and Airwaves had going for it was their music was competent, but there was nothing interesting about it at all, no matter how metaphysical Tom tried to get. You see, Tom DeLonge is what's called in the industry as a flake with an ego. Google Tom DeLonge, Alien Encounter, okay? Angels and Airwaves made a big splash with their debut single, The Adventure, and since then, not so much. They've recorded 5 albums, each one making less of a commercial and critical impact. In 2008, following the near death of Blink-182 drummer Travis Barker, the Blink guys decided to put aside their differences and try to record again, but like the fighting parents they describe in their song Stay Together for the Kids, they really should have stayed apart. The guys recorded separately and spoke through lawyers. The whole thing was toxic. We ended up with the 2011 album Neighborhoods, and, you know, some touring, and then, depending on who is speaking, Tom left or he was kicked out of the band. At last report, Tom wanted Blink to be a legacy band and not record new material, but tour off of their old albums, while Mark and Travis want to continue with Blink. And they've brought in Matt Skiba of Alkaline Trio to take Tom's place, and they're talking new album. So here we end up with To the Stars, which is made up of material Tom wrote for Blink and Angels and Airwaves. Should you buy it? Oh, hell no. But in the songs, there is the groundwork of a maturing, to a point, we're still talking about a guy who writes jerk-off songs, musician. On this album, there's a little less snot-nosed brattiness found in Blink, and way less pretentious crap than on an Angels and Airwaves album. Now, if you didn't tell me this was Tom DeLonge, I would think it was a smaller band that, you know, maybe opened for Blink-182 that had that Blink-182 sound, but put their own spin on it. So, the songs, they're still childish, with songs titled Golden Showers in the Golden States and Circle Jerk Pit, and some of the songs are about being a confused teen or just hanging with your buds. The songs Animals and Landscape are probably Angels and Airwaves cuts. And the song The Invisible Parade is about Tom's brother who served in the Navy in Iraq. I'm giving To the Stars 2 stars. Remember, we're still talking about a guy who sings about his dick. So, 2 stars within the we're not talking about real music to start with scale. But, you know, it was interesting, which is why I'm talking about it. Will I want to listen to it again? No. Should you? If you're a Blink fan, it's an interesting chapter in the Blink 182 saga. And if you're an Angels and Airwaves fan, move out of your parents' house. You know, stop quoting The Matrix, you dork. Now, let's listen to real mature punk rock. On the Road right now is the North American touring production of the musical Once. Based on a 2007 film of the same name, Once is about a week in the lives of two musicians, only known as Guy and Girl, whose brief encounter encourages each other to take chances professionally and personally. Once, the movie, was a sweet, warm, heartfelt love story that set the world afire with its perfect love story and a soundtrack that made people's hearts break and heal simultaneously. The breakout and forever being mangled at karaoke bars' worldwide hit song from the movie, Falling Slowly, set many a hearts aflutter and won the Oscar for Best Original Song at the 80th Academy Awards. It was also nominated for a Grammy for Best Song Written for Film, TV, or Visual Medium, but lost to Love You I Do, sung by Jennifer Hudson in the film version of Dreamgirls. Once the film wasn't a musical film like, say, a Gene Kelly film, it was a movie about musicians, so for them to break out into song was not unnatural. And the film didn't have just one perfect song, it had a whole album full of touching, memorable songs. The songs like When Your Mind's Made Up, If You Want Me, and Broken-Hearted Hoover Fixer Sucker Guy, all wonderful in their own right. The album was a certified hit, and Entertainment Weekly placed it number 2 on their 25 new classic soundtrack albums list that's from 1983 to 2008. Right behind the soundtrack for Rushmore? Nah, that's not right. Anyway, Once the movie, with its simple setting, touching human story, and absolutely perfect soundtrack, Eat Shit Rushmore, was perfectly set up for an adaptation to the stage. The transfer from screen to stage doesn't have as an interesting backstory as the film. Once the film was shot in Ireland, around Dublin, on a shoestring budget, some of the outdoor scenes were filmed with hidden cameras to get real reactions from people on the street, you know, which helped save money from having to hire extras. The two leads, Glenn Hasnard and Markita Erglova, fell in love during production and toured as a musical group, The Swell Season, after the movie took off. All the love behind the scenes showed up on screen, giving the film an honest feel, and the stage version captures all the honesty of the film and more. I'm giving Once the Musical 4 stars. Yes, it is pretty much a perfect stage musical. There's one minor quibble, but not enough to reduce its star rating. The stage version pretty much follows the plot of the film version. Both are about the guy, a street performer living with his father, who also works at his dad's vacuum repair shop, and the girl, as she's an immigrant Czechoslovakian flower seller who hears the guy's music one day on the street and they strike up a friendship. They bond over her broken vacuum cleaner and really connect when they stop at a music store where the girl is allowed to practice on one of their pianos. He teaches her one of his songs, Falling Slowly, and she passionately decides he needs to record that song and the other songs he has written. As the story progresses, we learn she has a child and an estranged husband, and he an estranged girlfriend who lives in New York, but in all honesty, they love each other. Throughout both versions, the guy tries to start a relationship with the girl, and she constantly pushes him away, even though she admits to him, in Czech, so he doesn't understand, that she loves him. They finish the album and go their separate ways. Now, the stage version runs a little under 2.5 hours, including a 15-minute intermission. That might sound long considering the film version is 86 minutes, and that's with the credits. That's the only minor quibble with the stage show. The stage show doesn't feel unnecessarily bloated. You know, it's long because they're able to take more time with the songs. Because the orchestration is beautiful and haunting. The choreography is hypnotic. A standout amongst almost all standouts is the song If You Want Me. It's breathtaking, mournful, and graceful. For a majority of the show, it felt like you were sitting in a vacuum. The musical number seemed to take everyone's breath away, and then it was followed by uproarious applause after each musical performance. In my opinion, you know, they could have dropped the intermission, maybe tightened up a few scenes. You know, there are a few moments, just a few moments of lost momentum. Also, the opening of the stage show has the cast singing Irish songs, which aren't in the movie, or actually even listed in the program, but that one actually, you know what, once you've seen the whole show, it is a nice addition. But that's a minor quibble with the show. The rest of it absolutely is stunning and breathtaking. The cast was uniformly great from the leads to the supporting cast. In the production I saw here in Chicago, the lead, Guy, they were rotating through their understudies, and as far as I could tell, we landed on a winner. Ryan Link was absolutely perfect as the guy, making it his own character, but reminding you why we love the movie. For the role of the girl, we had Dani DeWall, and she was wonderful as well. Her accent, you know, might have wavered ever so slightly when she was singing, but in no way really pulls you out of her performance. Also, she totally nails that Eastern European stubbornness. Now, why doesn't girl end up with the guy? In the movie and stage version, she seems to be fighting her own desires. Well, you see, I'm Polish, and for some reason, Eastern Europeans, especially those from the quote-unquote old country, have a stubborn streak in them to the point where, you know, they almost seem irrational. Western Europeans, yeah, you have your own stubbornness, but it's a different style. Now, yes, the girl has a husband. We don't know what happened, but they're no longer together. But it seems to her, once you're married, that's it. But, you know, she and this guy can go and still, you know, record a beautiful album of music. And that's it. Coming from an Eastern European heritage, I sat there going, yeah, that rings kind of true. I've met people, and some might be part of my family, who are just a bunch of stubborn Polacks. So, yeah. As I said earlier, the choreography is some of the best on stage. It organically grows from the songs, and what's most amazing is that all the music is played by the actors on stage, and they play violin, cello, mandolin, guitar, accordion, electric bass, drums. This is an amazingly talented cast. It's difficult enough to be a good Broadway actor who can sing and dance and act, and then to be a talented violin player on top of that and dance around? Whoa! The set for the stage is simple and understated. A semicircle that has the look of a bar with mirrors covering its walls. Sting's stage show, The Last Ship, is getting a simple set wrong. Once is getting a simple set right. Another thing I really liked about Once the Musical is that even though it takes place in Ireland, they don't overplay the quote-unquote Irish thing too much. Americans have this image in their head of Ireland, of this place of brogue accents and scarves and pints, to the point it's almost a shtick. Yes, in Once, they have accents and scarves and pints, but it isn't played up. This story actually could have easily been picked up and placed in Pittsburgh or Cleveland. Sting overplayed the UK shtick in his show. You know, one of many flaws in that show. And the proof that once the musical got it so many things right, it cleaned up at the 2012 Tony Awards, winning Best Musical, Best Book, Best Actor, Direction, Orchestration, Scenic Design, and was nominated for Best Choreography and Actress. Now, should you see Once the Movie before seeing Once the Stage Show? You don't have to, but why deny yourself the pleasure? Also, the stage show moves quickly at parts, and having a little bit of an understanding beforehand doesn't hurt. So unless you're heartless and don't like passion, seeing Once the Musical only once will not be enough. I'd like to thank you for downloading or streaming this episode of Media Riot. The podcast is over. The podcast is done. Go see a movie. Listen to an album because the podcast is over. Thanks, love. Media Riot is an Illinois production. Please like us and follow us on Facebook and subscribe to us on iTunes and get podcasts as soon as they're posted. We'll see you next time. Bye now.